Hi, I'm Philip Shepherd. It's my pleasure to welcome you to this amazing once-in-a-lifetime conference, and especially to the Meditation and Breathwork channel, which I'm proud to be sponsoring because meditation and breathwork are essential to my teachings. I'm the founder of the Embodied Present Process, or TEP, which is based on my two books and is taught worldwide. And here's one thing I believe about meditation and breathwork. You limit your experience of both if you imagine that your mind is just the thoughts in your head. Your mind permeates your every cell. Every stirring of energy within your body is an expression of it. So, if you wish to calm your mind, the most direct route is to develop the skills that enable you to feel the body's energy and ground it in the spaciousness of the present. That's what my work is about. If that appeals to you, I hope you'll check out my two presentations, one on this channel and one on the main stage. You might also be interested in a special offer exclusive to the Embodiment Conference to listen to one of my embodied meditations for yourself for free. You can find a link to the special offer in the description of this presentation or on the show notes. And now, enjoy the presentation.
So, Dad, I'm going to hand over to you for your presentation. Welcome and thank you.
Okay, thank you, Alison. And I'm glad to see, kind of to see everyone who's here, or at least know everyone is here. I want to start with a story. It is a true story. Some years ago, I was on an overground train going toward Liverpool Street in central London. I was with a friend of mine named Roshni. She had just graduated from UCL, where Alison went. And we were sitting across from each other, facing each other, and talking a little bit about whatever. And behind her, facing me, was a young man. I could see the top of him. He was a very strong man. His arms were muscular and seemed to be almost as big as my thighs and his torso. He was a very strong guy. He was just talking on his phone, and I didn't think anything of it. Then all of a sudden, or he was just listening mainly, and then all of a sudden he burst out, "What the F? But I'm not a monk." He didn't say F. He said the full word, of course. I wasn't so happy to hear that. And then he stopped again, and I could see he was listening on to whoever. And a moment later, again, he said, "What the F? I'm not a monk." And I was getting a little disturbed about the language. I, of course, didn't like it much. And after a little while, again, he burst out with the same phrase, "But I'm not a monk." So I stood up, leaned across the chair toward him, and I said, "But I am a monk." And all of a sudden, this guy looked at me as if first time he'd seen me, it probably was. He rushes around toward me to start talking to me. And I was afraid, oh no, what have I gotten myself into? And then he says, "Are you a monk?" And I said, "Yes." And I started to explain, "I'm a yogic monk. I teach meditation." But I could hardly get out a word. And then he said, "Are you a Shaolin monk?" And when he said that and looking at the strong, muscular guy, I realized that actually he's not looking to spend his life contemplating in a monastery or a seminary. So I started to explain some things about meditation. A little background first. Later I found out he's a performance artist, which is why he built himself up to be so strong and healthy. And he had just been talking to his partner, his girlfriend, who apparently wanted him to tone down his lifestyle rather than beef up his body. So for a couple of minutes as we were on the train, I was able to explain a little bit about meditation. I told him there's many reasons for meditation. You can find peace of mind, you can find relaxation, you may have too much stress, you may want to concentrate more, you may even want a healthier body, which is also a good reason for doing meditation. There's other reasons, of course, for doing meditation. I then tried to get a little bit into my story of how I got into meditation. In those days, I was in my late teens, and I was just hearing about some strange thing called yoga. This was in a small town in the Midwest USA, in a university town. And I heard something about meditation from a friend or two, and gradually it became a little more interesting. I would read a book, a magazine article. I would go to a lecture, perhaps like this, except live. And I finally realized, yes, it's something I should try. Later, looking back, I realized there were, broadly speaking, two reasons why I did take up meditation. I didn't have it articulated in my mind at that moment. But on the one hand, I was very nervous. I didn't have any self-confidence, not much anyway. I was shy. my mind was chattering always a mile a minute, going from one thought to another, to another, to another. And my emotions might go from, in one moment, from ecstasy, feeling very confident and self-assertive and feeling good. Another moment, feeling this is miserable. I can't do anything. Nothing's working. And everything was going up and down, in and out like that all the time. So on the one hand, these are one reason, one set of reasons why I started meditation. On the other hand, I also wanted to understand, what is life all about? Why am I here? Where did I come from? What should I be doing? Where am I going? The deeper questions, you might say. And eventually I found that meditation does help us find all of these answers. Anyway, I tried to get a little bit of this across to the man on the train. And we eventually approached Bethnal Green, the train station he was getting off at. And as he's headed toward the door, I gave him my card. I shook his hand and said, my name is Dr. Jyoti Rupananda. And he smiled back and looked at my card and said, thanks. My name is Mr. Animal. And with a name like that, and a physique like that, and a temperament like that, I was glad we were friends. Now, I don't know if Mr. Animal, that was, of course, his stage name as a performance artist. I don't know if he ever got much into meditation. We lost contact after a while. But I think for just about everyone, meditation is something that's good. Now, that was an introductory story, but what we'll cover today is I'll talk a bit about meditation and some important tools for meditation. We'll have a little bit of practice, and then we should hopefully have time for some Q&A. So I just said the word practice. Well, let's start with a little exercise, something I often do in my classes, and there's many variations on this exercise. But first, before we start the exercise, think for a moment, what is the most important thing you need if you're going to do meditation or if you're going to do anything? I don't know if there's time for people to put their answers in the chat window. Silence is what Monkey says. Any other suggestions? Okay, well, we're cutting straight to the point because the most important thing you need is breathing. Breathing, of course, is what we need for anything and everything. But what people often don't realize is that breathing is something we can be conscious of, and there's different types of breathing also. For example, studies show that when you're, and I think experience shows that if you're breathing very rapidly, perhaps you've just run after the bus and you've just got on the bus, and then maybe you try to recall the name of your friend who you just saw, or the person you saw the first thing in the morning, or someone's phone number. Even though these are things you know, your rapid breathing makes your mind, your brain a little bit out there, and you're not thinking so clearly. Slow breathing is equated with clear thinking, conscious thinking. However, it's not a matter, I've learned to say this too because of questions I get, it's not a matter of controlling your breath so you're breathing slowly. That doesn't work. But if your breathing is naturally slow or becoming slower, it is a sign usually of more clear thinking. So let's do a simple breathing exercise for a couple of minutes. It could be longer. And as I said, there's many variations on this, which you can use anytime if you need to calm down a little bit. So let's close our eyes. Another good factor for meditation, another useful factor. This is mainly observation, this exercise. So now observe your breath as you're breathing in and out at the tip of your nose. Your eyes are closed, and of course you cannot see your breathing anyway, but just observe the breath, the air going in and out at the tip of your nose. You might, if you think about it, you might notice that the air is probably a little warmer as you exhale, where it had been a little bit cooler as you inhale. Of course, it may depend where you are, what part of the world. This is just a little observation tip. Now, taking this a little further or deeper, see if you can observe the passage of the air as you inhale through your nostrils, down through your windpipe, and as it fills up your lungs. see if you can observe the passage of the air during that time. Now, the reverse. See if you can observe the passage of the air from your lungs as you inhaled, as it goes up through your windpipe, and then out into the world through your nostrils. You might imagine the air surrounding you and filling you with a sense of peace or harmony. Okay, take a couple of more breaths and then let's open our eyes. I find even a small exercise like that may leave me feeling a bit of calmness. And sometimes, like now, even though there's, you may not hear it outside, there's trucks and buses and cars. Just outside my window, still with all that, just a simple exercise like that felt, made me feel, let me feel a little bit of calmness. So to make sure we're on the same page, let's see what meditation is. There are lots of types of meditation, and as far as I know, they're all beneficial. There's a walking meditation where an individual or a group of people may walk, perhaps in a park, perhaps on a city street or in the countryside. And the challenge of that would probably be to see what you observe. At the end of that walk, maybe it's 10 minutes or 2 hours, the leader may say, how many types of trees did you observe? How many people did we see? Was the land more level or more hilly? Things like that. So that's a walking meditation. There's also breathing meditation, similar to what we did. And as I said, there's many variations on this exercise. There's scanning your body, where, as if I understand, you would sit there probably with your eyes closed and observe things about yourself, your posture, how your internal organs are feeling, etc. There's also meditation, which would be studying, perhaps studying books of spirituality, religion, philosophy, reading a page or a chapter, and then reflecting on it, perhaps writing about it. And that's a type of meditation. Now, my spiritual teacher, my guru, gives another type of definition for meditation. He calls it concentrated thinking. So what does concentrated thinking mean? Thinking, we know what that is. Concentrated, when I first started using this concept, I got the idea from some students that concentration means like this. I've got to really concentrate. But for me, concentration is more of a flow. The word concentrate, coming from the Latin, means something like toward the center, moving toward the center. Can we put that slide of the concentric circles up, Maggie? Okay, this is a simple example of concentric circles. You can find millions of examples on the internet. The outside circle, the furthest one out, would represent to me how the average human mind is on a normal day, where you might be thinking one thing, then another, then another, then another. Psychologists say that on average, we hold a thought for 3 to 5 seconds. Not very long, I think. And our thoughts may be consecutive. I've got to go shopping. Guests are coming over for dinner. What time should I start preparing dinner? Those are different thoughts, but consecutive. Or the thoughts might be, I've got to do shopping for dinner. Oh yeah, and there's a birthday present for my mother I have to buy. And I wonder how my favorite football team did last night. And that guy at work, he's really bothering me. And on like that. So that would be represented by the outside circle. Through calmness, through meditation or other exercises such as breathing, gradually our thoughts will become more focused, more calm, more still. And we go toward one of the inner circles, and then a further inner circle, and a further inner circle. And finally, we might say our goal of meditation in one way is to reach that center point where we are completely focused on the ideal, the idea, the thought that we want. We can take the slide down now, Aggie, if you don't mind. So that's an idea of how meditation works, where when I sit every day for meditation, sometimes I'm nice and peaceful in the beginning, but it may be that my mind is thinking about all these things and I've got to give a talk on embodiment conference and I've got to do this and that. And then it takes a while for my thoughts to come down more towards symbolically toward that center circle. And that is one of the main goals of meditation, where we have concentrated thinking, where our thoughts become more focused. However, I should add something which would be part of another talk or another class that I might give, is that when yogis talk about concentrated thinking, they don't mean that you're going to concentrate on perhaps how much profit can my company make, or I hope that my football team does, you know, really beat badly that other team, or I really have to go yell at my neighbor because he's doing this or that, or other things which are not very productive. Here, concentrated thinking in meditation refers to thinking of something sublime, something of a more pure nature, which is what ultimately human beings are about. So that's a little bit of what we might call meditation. Now, another question which I referred to in my talk with just now, with in my story about Mr. Animal, who I met, and that was his real stage name, I don't think it was his real name, is why do we do meditation? And just to repeat, because it's an important point, there are many reasons and virtually all of them are good. I've only found one reason which wasn't good. Years ago, I met a man who, I guess I met him through a friend, and he said he was interested in meditation. We got talking, he came over to our place and I started to teach him our formal meditation practice, which anyone can learn. It's always free and it's a very effective practice if you keep up with it. And as with anyone, when I'm sitting with that person, I ask, why do you want to do meditation? Some people want peace of mind. Some people are nervous, many other reasons. And he said, I asked him, why do you want to do meditation, sir? And, or whatever I said, he said, so I can control my wife. Well, mentally, my jaw dropped. It may have dropped physically also. And I took a minute or a little while to think, that's strange, what can I say? And eventually I made it clear to him that meditation is about self-control. Self-control is a way to find inner peace. When I have at least a little bit of that inner peace, calmness, clarity of thinking, hopefully I've developed a sense of love to at least some degree, then why should I worry about controlling others? Which is basically impossible in any real sense, unless, you know, you're in a certain situation as a prison guard or something. And then you're only controlling the bodies of the people, not the real person. So that's the only odd situation I've had. But as I say, we might meditate because we want to have less stress, more calmness, or we might want to meditate so we can find, as I said earlier, the meaning of life, inner peace, pure universal love. Things like that are why we meditate. So a question that I think is important relating to this is, what is the nature of human beings? Because if we understand our true nature, meditation can help us move in that direction. In Sanskrit, there's a word I'll put in the chat window. Some of you may be familiar with it. It's pronounced dharma, D-H-A-R-M-A. There's a more common word that's similar from Buddhism called dhamma, D-H-A-M-M-A. Dharma is a Sanskrit word which means the essential nature of anything, without which it would not be that thing. In simple way, we can say it simply means the essential nature of something. So a chair has the dharma of sitting on it. You may also step on the chair to get a book off that high shelf, or you may put your groceries on it, or you may use the chair to keep the door open if you don't have a doorstop. And those are okay, but if you cannot sit on it, you cannot call it a chair. Fire, the essential nature of fire, the dharma of fire is to burn, to give off heat. If it crackles and changes colors and it's flickering, it may be a stage prop from a Hollywood movie. But if it is giving off fire, giving off heat, then we can call it fire. So on we can go, but what is the essential nature of human beings, the Dharma of human beings? And again, Dharma means without which it would not be that which it seems to be. Any suggestions, any questions? Or not questions, any ideas? Okay, well, there's many things that people say are the essential nature of human beings: to survive, to cooperate, to compete, to work, many, many things that people say. But according to yoga, the Dharma, the essential nature of human beings, is something more general. And someone said to love, and that seems pretty close. In yoga philosophy, we say the Dharma of human beings is to be happy, to find happiness. And as my guru, as my teacher says, we want happiness so we can have peace of mind. Now, in the world today, or throughout human history, people are always seeking to be happy. I've never met anyone who wakes up in the morning and says, today I want to be angry and sad and morose and listless. Some people may be that way, and they may program themselves to be that way, but really what they want is to be happy. Now, the question here is, how do I find real happiness? Going to a restaurant, going to a movie when we can, going to a club, meeting your friends, going running, other sports, these are all fine things. Having a good meal with your family or your friends, these are all great things to do. Nothing can be said against it, but it won't give you complete happiness, because that meal will end, or that movie will end, or you're running and you stop running and you go home. So the happiness you get from any of these things is fine, no problem at all from a yogic point of view, but it's not permanent. So to find permanent happiness, we need to seek out something which reminds us or helps us identify with our true permanent nature. Another phrase related to this that my teacher says, he says, in the living being, there's a thirst for limitlessness. So the happiness we want is something that's unlimited. How do we find that? Well, meditation is, of course, a tool, a way to do that. And part of an essential point we want to talk about today is one of the basic tools of meditation. And this is a mantra. As I said earlier, there are different types of meditations, but the idea of concentrated thinking for meditation deals, at least in the beginning stages, with using a mantra. What is a mantra? I think many of us have heard the word, but maybe not in relation to yogic practices. A mantra is, simply speaking, a word or a phrase that we repeat in the mind. A word or a phrase that we repeat in the mind. Naturally, implicitly, the word is something positive, something of a sublime nature, something which helps us to identify with our deeper, purest nature, as the person said here about love. So in my practice and the teaching that I do, if someone is interested in meditation, hopefully for a good reason, then I can teach them a personal mantra, which is something they don't share with anyone else. It's just between the teacher and the student. And the mantra has certain qualities which help it to work as a mantra, to function as a mantra. We identify three main characteristics of a mantra, of a standard mantra. One is that it's rhythmic, meaning that when you have a personal mantra, it will be two syllables, and you say one syllable as you breathe in and one as you breathe out. This makes it very easy to keep in your mind, because your breathing, of course, is very, very regular, normal, natural. A second quality is, we might call it a vibrational quality, in that the mantra has a certain sound, a certain resonance, which helps to connect our mind with the universal energy, universal mind. In this way, we can reach a higher state of awareness, a higher state of consciousness. And a third quality, maybe it's more mundane, is that the mantra has a meaning. As you think, so you become. So if I always say to myself, I'm miserable, no one likes me, I can't do anything, it may not be true, but I may end up being like that, because that's the thought that I have in my mind. So a mantra, of course, always has a positive and, shall we say, universal meaning. So we'll do a little bit of meditation now, and I want to explain the mantra that we'll use. And then after this, we'll have time for a Q&A. So if Aggie can put up the slide with Bhavanam Kevalam, and I'll explain this. This mantra does not have all of the qualities that I just mentioned because it's more than two syllables. This was originally developed for chanting. And if you go to YouTube, for example, and type in the words Bhavanam Kevalam, you can find many examples of people chanting this with whatever instrumentation and whatever type of music they like. It's good with, it can be chanted with virtually any tune, I guess. So we use this for meditation just in a beginning stage. It's not a personal mantra, but just to give people a sample of what it is. What this means, the word Baba, these are all from the Sanskrit language, although they may occur in other languages, the words. The word Baba means beloved. What do I love the most? It may be a person, it may be an ideal, it may be a goal or an object. Nam means name. And the word Kevalam means only. So if I say it forwards, it doesn't really make so much sense, beloved name only. But if we change it around a little bit, we come up with the English there that we see at the bottom. Everything is an expression of love. We might say everything is an expression of infinite love, but it's all the same. And as I said, this mantra doesn't really use the classic mantric formula. Partly because it was developed for chanting, and myself and other of my colleagues, we often use this in as a sample for meditation, as we'll do now. So we'll try a little meditation now with this for a few minutes, and then I'll say a little more, and then we can have some Q&A. So to do this meditation. And as I say, this is replicable. What I'll describe now, if you can remember or make up your own idea, you can do anytime. And if you don't have a personal meditation practice, sit anytime in the day. I can talk a little more about the ideal times for meditation and just repeat Bhavanam Kevalam, or go on YouTube and listen to the chanting while you're doing meditation or yoga. So let's close our eyes now. And again, similar to what we did earlier, to start with, just observe your breathing. But now, skipping a step or two, see if you can observe your breathing all the way from your nostrils to your lungs and out again. Just observe that flow of the breathing. When you breathe in for a moment, imagine you're sending the air to any part of your body that has aching or tightness or discomfort of any sort. So imagine the air is going in toward that part of your body. It may be in your stomach, your knee, your arm, your ankle, your nose, anywhere. If you have any tightness or aches, and imagine the air is going in there and taking that achingness or tightness and just dispersing it into the air as you exhale. Okay, and now, after you've done that a little bit, and you're observing your breathing, now bring into your mind the mantra Bhavanam Kevalam. Everything is an expression of love, or love is all there is. And you don't have to think about the meaning, but just do your best to keep the mantra in your mind. Perhaps when you breathe in, repeat the whole mantra silently, Bhavanam Kevalam. And when you breathe out, again, silently, repeat the mantra Bhavanam Kevalam. And let's keep this up for a few minutes. Let's take a couple more breaths, repeating the mantra Bhavanam Kegalam in case it did fade away from your mind. And then let's open our eyes now. And we can put off the screen here. So it would be interesting, if possible, to know how people felt about this. I'll have an email. We'll have an email up at the end that you can write to, because it's not easy now to get everyone's feedback. I do find that in early days of meditation, people may be surprised or shocked even that while they're sitting quietly for meditation, the mind is going all over the place. They're hearing so many sounds that they didn't hear when they were just normally doing their daily work, because your mind is becoming more quiet. And initially you do become more aware of things, stimuli that you may not have realized before. And because your mind is not, hopefully not occupied actively with the chatter, you may be more aware of all of the chatter that's going on. A small story and then one or two things, and we'll have some Q&A. One reason I realized I needed meditation was one evening when I was in university. In those days, I was in the dorm in the halls and shared a room with a friend of mine, with another fellow, and he was out for the evening. And I thought I would try an exercise, which I had heard about because I'd read different New Age magazines and gone to lectures, as I said. And this was called what they call a candle exercise. In this exercise, you are in, say, a dark room, quiet, no one to disturb you, and you light a candle and you stare at the flame of the candle as long as you can. And in theory, as the articles would have said, you might start to see things about your past life or your inner life or things that you weren't aware of before. And it sounded quite mystical and quite exciting. So my roommate James was out for the evening. It was evening time, yeah, dark. And I locked the door so none of my friends would come in just to say, how are you doing? And I lit this candle and I thought, I'm going to sit here minute after minute for a long time and just stare at that candle flame and see what sort of mystical experiences I can have. And I lit the candle. I sat on the floor, you know, the door was locked, as I said, lit the candle, and about that long was all I could sit, maybe 10 seconds maximum. And I just had to get up. I just didn't have any concentration at all. I just could not sit there doing this strange thing. Blew out the candle, got my jacket, went outside as soon as I could to look for friends so I could do something. So as I got more into meditation or learning about meditation in those days, I realized, yes, I need something that I can hold on to, something, some tool that will really work. Because as I said, I realized with the candle exercise, I had no patience, no possibility of doing internal concentration. But when I met a teacher, perhaps someone like what I am now, he showed me a mantra, gave me the technique I needed to do the meditation. And it was a positive technique and it was affirming. This was a human being, not a candle, who could affirm or confirm that yes, you too can do meditation. So learning from books or YouTube or lectures like this is a fine way to begin, but ultimately it's good if one can find a teacher. If you have a teacher or not at this point, and you want to practice with Bhavanam Kevalam or breathing or any other technique you have, a couple of points which are very useful for meditation, any level of meditation, would be try to find a regular time of day and a regular place that you can do it. This is not always possible. But if you can set aside perhaps a corner of your room or another room in your house, or if you go to a library or any quiet place like that, try to find a regular time and a regular place to meditate, as regular as possible. As I said, it's not always possible. And these two things, a regular time and a regular place if possible, they put your mind in a habit so that yes, the meditation is something that I'm ready to do now. We probably, most of us have habits for when we eat our meals, when we go to sleep. If you're working or studying, you probably have a daily routine of going to work or going to your classes, whatever. So do the same for meditation. it becomes much easier. If, as other teachers say, this is not a secret of mine, if you think, I'll wait for the right time when I'm in the mood for meditation, it won't happen, or it will rarely happen. Same with anything. If you want to improve your physique and you want to go cycling or swimming, and you wait till you're in the mood for cycling, swimming, weightlifting, etc., it may not happen. Make it happen. That's what makes meditation or many other things work. And also a common idea is try to do meditation twice a day. Morning and evening is good. As I said, regular times is ideal. And these things can all make it work. Now we have about 10 minutes left. So I wonder if there's any Q&A. I'd like to hear what's on your mind.
Thank you, Dedar. There's a couple of questions have come in so far, and I'm sure other people may have questions as well. So the first one here is from Monkey, who's actually one of our panelists. And they're asking, so what is your thought on the effect of repeating mantras, even when not concentrating? So for example, playing a recording, and I may mispronounce this, of Maham Ritunyan Jaya Mantra while driving and singing along. Will its presence and power break through to the subconscious mind and have a positive effect, even if it isn't as strong? So if you're doing other things at the same time.
Yeah, no, that's a very good thing to do. The way we teach meditation is a personal mantra that you do twice a day, ideally. But also my teacher, my guru, recommends doing what he calls half meditation, which is exactly what Monkey is saying. While you're waiting at the bus stop, while you're cycling, while you're doing some paperwork, chatting, whatever, eating your meal, just keep the mantra in the back of your mind. It won't be as deep as meditation, real meditation, but it reinforces the effect of the meditation. And it'll be filling your mind with a positive thought minute after minute, day after day. So it's a very good thing to do, I think, Monkey.
Perfect, thank you. And I've got another question here. Is it important for meditation to be the same every day, or can it differ as your mood or life change?
I'm going to guess, unless the person can clarify, I'm not sure what you mean by being the same. As I just said, it's ideally the same time, but the results of meditation may be different from time to time, certainly, and it doesn't mean the meditation is not working. Sometimes I'm doing my meditation, my concentration is more out there rather than in here, or I'm feeling maybe some negative, what we call negative emotions, if there is such a thing. And I might be mentally chattering a little bit during my meditation. That's not bad. It's just maybe means my mind has to release things. But it also reminds me that, I'm not really focusing on the mantra. So it's not important for meditation to be the same every day, but it's very useful if you can keep a regular pattern of meditation, but don't beat yourself up if you don't keep a pattern. I think any good coach or teacher would say that.
So Claudia, that question came from you. Does that answer your question? Otherwise you can unmute yourself and speak directly.
Yeah, if you want to.
The same style as far as some days or some months, I'm really concentrated on the mantra. And then suddenly I lose the mantra because I needed to be quiet in silence. So is that important to be always, doing the same style of guided or mantra?
I think my response would be, I think it's good if you're going in the same direction. There may be different techniques that help you. I, of course, do with mantra meditation plus other levels of meditation we teach, which are beyond mantra. But it sounds to me that everything you're doing is putting you in the same direction toward inner peace, toward realization. So
thank you. I've got another question here, which is, how do I find my own mantra?
Good luck. People do ask me how I choose a mantra for them, and it's basically a secret. Part of the answer I'll say is that I know how to give a mantra to Allison or Monkey or Anik or Tom, Dick or Harry because of two things. One is the training I've had in our ashram, you can say, in where I took my training to become a teacher, and also from the meditation I do, which connects me with a certain consciousness. And in these two ways together, I understand what mantra to give to a person. In our tradition, as in many traditions, I think the mantra is secret. It's not to be put on your text messages or on your screensaver or whatever, or to tell your friends what it is. It loses its ability then. But let me say something very general, which might help, is we look for a mantra which has a resonance with something about that person, not the clothing they're wearing, not their hairstyle, something deeper. But it's a mantra we look for a mantra which has a resonance with this person or that person. Yeah.
And I think this question follows on, and then there's a couple in the Q&A that we'll come to, but this question is, would you ever intone the mantra rather than repeat it silently?
Would I ever intone it rather than repeat it silently?
Yes. So saying it out loud, I guess.
No. In our system, the system I teach, a mantra is only said out loud when the teacher and the student are talking privately. So I would never intone it, but there are some mantras which you can do that, I guess. It depends what instruction you've gotten from a teacher or what you understand. But no, I would not intone it verbally, no.
Okay, great. And then I've got a couple of questions in the Q&A. So one is that, is Shavasana at the end of yoga practice a meditation? And the person asking the question says their student calls it a meditation. Would you consider it to be a meditation?
Shavasana?
Yes.
In a way it is. I've had some students in the past who cannot do meditation because their minds are so whatever. I tell them do Shavasana twice a day for 5 or 10 minutes. In at least 2 cases, I've gotten fantastic feedback from that. It's just what they needed. So it doesn't have, Shavasana doesn't give you the inner meaning that a mantra does. It doesn't remind you as a mantra does. It doesn't remind you of your deeper source, but it can serve some basic it has some basic advantages, yeah, like relaxing you. And it's healthy for the body also.
Right. And then I've got a follow-on question from the same person, which is asking, is So Hum a popular mantra? And is there a favorite one of yours?
Well, it's probably popular. I don't use that mantra. As I say, we have a certain class or category of mantras that I teach. But So Hum is popular. One thing is, I'll try to say this very quickly. The way a mantra is created is not just by someone looking in a newspaper or a book and saying, oh, that word sounds nice. But as I understand from sources I've read, and as I understand anyway, a mantra will be created when a person of a very high mental or spiritual development will intone internally this mantra, maybe day after day, until it has a certain power to it. There's a very good book called The Way of the White Clouds by a man named Lama Anagarika Govinda. I'll put this in, let me put that in the chat window.
Thank you.
He was a if I'm spelling that right, he was a German-born Buddhist monk, and he had many great adventures. Yeah, that's it. And in that book, at one point, he describes how his Lama creates a mantra. And it's similar to what I've just said. So one can use any word. You can use the word 1, 2, 3 as a mantra. You can use the word embodiment as a mantra. But it probably won't have the same effect, partly because you want something which has a deeper sublime meaning and also something which has been empowered, which has a resonance for you as a student, as a practitioner. Yeah. I don't know if I answered the question completely.
I have another question for you, Dada. This is from me. I'm curious, you mentioned earlier on about the value of having a teacher.
Yeah.
And I'd love you to talk a little bit more about that and also being part of a community. I know for me, being part of a community is important, but I'd love to hear your views on that.
Okay, well, in Sanskrit, and I think in Buddhism, a community is called a Sangha. Sangha means those who are moving together, something like that. And for meditation, some people are very private. They just want to do by themselves. But a community of people that support you, whether in meditation, diet, sports, intellectual activities, it's important. It's very helpful. As far as having a teacher, I tried different things like the candle exercise, for example, before I found a teacher. I found, as I briefly said earlier, that a teacher, if the teacher knows what they're doing, and if you can rely and trust on the teacher, it's an immeasurable benefit to have a teacher in meditation. we need teachers for simple things. Did anyone learn to tie their shoes by themselves? Did anyone even learn to brush their teeth by themselves? So having a teacher, as long as you can understand that it's a reliable, qualified person, I think it's an immeasurable help. People may not want a teacher, and I won't force anyone, of course, but it's very helpful to have a teacher and to have a community. But you have to maybe take a little time to see if is this the right teacher, is this the right community? It doesn't happen overnight. And I don't do it because someone tells me. I have to find it myself or experience it myself.
Yeah. So it sounds like feeling into it, because that's what I was going to be my next question. If I wish to find a teacher, how do I know that they're qualified and reputable?
Yeah. In my book, which I'll promote here, I have in one chapter, in the last chapter, there's certain qualities we look for that are traditional in yoga that you look for to find a teacher. Some things like the teacher is a well-balanced person with a normal job, usually a family person, a person who has a high level of understanding of spiritual and intellectual subjects and other things like that. So there are certain qualifications that you can look for in a teacher that are standard in yogic teachings. Yeah. Perfect. Not just anyone who's, and certainly I wouldn't look for someone who's famous. It may be that a famous person is a good teacher, but my own personality, I tend to watch out for that. Yeah.
And someone says, can you just put the name of your book? Perhaps you could put it into the, I think I've done it. Meditation Search.
Okay, thanks. Yeah. Yeah. And you can find it online anywhere. Right. Yeah. And in some bookstores even. Yeah.
Perfect.
Okay. I don't know if you want to go on now.
I think we've just about come to the end of our time.
Okay,
so I've just got a few things I need to say to wrap things up. So firstly, Dada, thank you. That was beautiful presentation. And so I want to say thank you very much for that, for the practices. They were incredible. We're putting your links into the chat so people can catch that. And there's a question there about running training. I don't know if you want to answer that very quickly. Do you run training?
Well, we run different types of training. Yeah, it depends on what level you're at. So the person can contact me. Yeah. I think there's another slide which will have my email, but Aggie put my email down there. You can cut and paste or whatever. I think after we're off, this chat disappears. So people better...
Yes, people will need to capture the chat just to get all of those things.
Yeah.
And then just to remind everybody, in terms of we've got some other talks happening today on the Breath and Meditation channel. So at 2:00, we've got Kaira Duolingo talking about inviting in the ancestors, accepting the good that awaits us. At 4 p.m., we've got Daniel Ingram talking about skillfully navigating the dark night. There's obviously a huge number of other presentations happening on the other channels, so you've got lots of choice and still a few more days of the conference to go, so plenty more learning to be had. We do encourage you to join the Facebook group. There's one for the Meditation and Breathwork channel. I think, Aggie's putting all the details there, as well as for the Embodiment Conference overall. You can join a coffee break meeting, which is an opportunity to share all your learning and to network and meet other people. And obviously there's also the opportunity to own the full library. And I think there's a discount happening at the moment. So now's a good opportunity whilst the conference is still going on, if you want that richness of things to be learning over the probably long winter months, if we're all still stuck indoors, there's an opportunity for that for you there. I'd like to again thank our sponsor for the session, Philip Shepherd, and also Aggie for doing an amazing job on the tech hosting, super fast with everything. So thank you, Aggie, I really appreciate that. And Dada, can I just come back to you for kind of the last word, please?
Sure. Okay.
What is your top tip to remain embodied?
Okay, first I'm going to put in a small advertisement. At 12:00 on Sunday, I'm part of a panel about meditation with a psychologist, a friend of mine, and a Buddhist master. Which my psychologist friend, we've done several debates in London and other places about meditation. But my last tip is, you might say it's a public mantra. Mantras are secret, and this is a public secret. The main tip for meditation is practice makes perfect. There's many other mystical things I could say, but those don't matter if you're not practicing. So whatever practice you have, or if you want to learn a practice, just remember practice makes perfect. And thanks very much to Allison and Aggie and Yolanda and everyone else. Yeah.